Hello and welcome to Science World. After a clinical trial in Thailand, scientists have found that a medication used to treat HIV patients can also be effectively used as a preventative. Students at a U.S. university have developed a device that could bring improved water quality for millions in the developing world. And researchers say they now know how an important element that helped start life on Earth got here. The team's leader joins us later in our program. This, much more, are coming up for you on VOA's Science, Health, and Technology magazine, Science World. A U.S.-supported clinical trial in Thailand has concluded a medication used to treat patients infected with HIV can also act as an effective preventative for those at high risk of acquiring the virus that causes AIDS. Daniel Scharf reports from Bangkok.
Researchers from the United States and Thailand say a clinical trial of a medicine to prevent the spread of HIV showed a 49% reduction in risk among injected drug users. The study of the antiretroviral tenofovir began in 2005 and involved more than 2,400 men and women who inject drugs but were not infected with HIV. Half were given tenofovir and half a placebo. Both groups received counseling on drug abuse and HIV prevention. They were then monitored to see how many acquired the virus. There were 33 HIV infections among those taking the placebo and 17 among those taking the antiretroviral, a 49% reduction in risk. Patients who took the medication most consistently had the highest levels of protection, reducing their risk of infection by 74%. Dr. Michael Martin is chief of HIV research at the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention's Southeast Asia office. He says while researchers continue to strive for a vaccine that would offer total protection, tenofovir offers some of the most significant HIV prevention so far.
We know that it can prevent HIV infection among people who inject drugs, among men who have sex with men, and among heterosexual couples. So this is very good news for public health around the world.
The study was conducted by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in collaboration with the Bangkok Metropolitan Administration and the Thailand Ministry of Public Health. Tenofovir was approved for use in the United States for HIV treatment in 2001, but was only recently proven effective for prevention. A 2010 study in the U.S. showed, in combination with another drug, it reduced the risk of HIV infection among men who have sex with men by 44%. Testing in Botswana, Kenya, and Uganda demonstrated effectiveness among heterosexual couples and where one partner was infected with HIV. Injected drug use accounts for up to 80% of new HIV infections in Eastern Europe and Central Asia, 8% in the United States, and about 10% worldwide. Dr. Kuchit Chupanya is principal investigator for the study. He says now that tenofovir is proven effective for all high-risk groups, it is up to governments to bring it into their healthcare systems.
And we can save their life. I think everyone, not only Thailand, every country should be do this together.
An estimated 30 to 50% of injected drug users in Thailand are living with HIV. Those who participated in the trial reported a decrease in injected drug use, sharing needles, and unprotected sex. Researchers say that indicates that counseling and education on HIV continues to be one of the most effective forms of prevention. Daniel Scharf, VOA News, Bangkok.
This past Tuesday, China launched a 15-day manned space mission, continuing the ambitious goal of building its own space station. Shannon Van Sant reports from Beijing.
China launched the manned Shenzhou 10 spacecraft from a satellite launch center in the Gobi Desert. The spacecraft is carrying two men and one woman and will travel through space for 15 days. Chinese President Xi Jinping met with the astronauts before takeoff. She said the astronauts made Chinese people feel very proud. He said the mission is glorious and sacred. He said he is confident the crew will complete the mission successfully, and he looks forward to the astronauts' triumphant return. The spacecraft will go through two docking tests with the orbiting space lab module Tiangong-1. One test will be automatic and the other manual. Astronauts will also perform tests on the station's life support systems. The Tiangong serves as a prototype for a larger space station China plans to launch in 2020. The astronauts will also deliver a series of talks to primary and middle school students from aboard the Tiangong. Chinese state media reports the lectures will focus on physics. NASA has long used student outreach as a means of inspiring support for the U.S. space program. Morris Jones, an Australian space analyst, says China's expanding space program is part of an effort to show the Chinese people and the world the country's rising power.
If it wants to be a superpower class nation, that developing a very strong space program is one way that it can project that image both internally and externally to the outside world.
China was prevented from taking part in the International Space Station in part because of U.S. objections over the space program's link to China's military. China's future space station will weigh 60 tons and be about one-sixth the size of the International Space Station. Stephen Norper is an East Asia analyst with the New York-based Korean Society.
It really shows the transformation in China over the last decade. China now is so very different from where it was just a decade ago. It's grown so much in terms of its economic prowess, in terms of its political importance, and in terms of technological capabilities that make things like this next step in space very much significant and an important sign of where China stands in terms of its role as an emerging global player.
The space mission's crew includes China's second female astronaut to travel into space. Wang Yaping is also China's first astronaut, born in the 1980s. State-run media reports say she grew up in a farming family in China's Shandong province before being selected as an astronaut in 2010. Shannon Van Sant for VOA News, Beijing.
As you just heard, China launched a crew of astronauts, including its second female space traveler, for a 15-day manned space mission this past week. What we want to know in this week's Science World Quick Quiz is the name of the first Chinese female astronaut. From the following, was it A, Wang Yaping, B, Wang Zhengyi, or C, Liu Yang? Well, do you think you have the right answer? Stick around. The correct answer is coming up in just a little bit.
This is Science World on VOA. Be sure to visit our new website and blog at voanews.com/science.
When you need some precise information, you call on science for help. After a missed call in football's 2010 World Cup quarterfinals that caused such a stir, FIFA, football's world governing body, approved the development of goal line technology. Roseanne Skirbel has the report.
The 2010 World Cup missed call became obvious to fans, media, and officials who watched replays. Bjorn Linder's job is to make sure officiating mistakes like that never happen again. He's the chairman of Goal Control, the German-based company awarded the contract for this year's Confederations Cup. His team has been in Brazil for weeks prior to the upcoming matches as part of the FIFA certification process.
The whole system uses 14 cameras that are installed on the catwalk. We have 7 cameras per goal and computers that are connected to those cameras. The computer are catching the images, around 500 pictures per second.
Computers track the trajectory of the ball in real time and reconstruct the play.
And once the computer percepts the ball has crossed the goal line, it gives a signal to the referee watch. So all the referees on the field receive a signal and it vibrates and gives an optical signal goal, and he knows a goal has occurred.
Nick Fleming is a London-based science and technology writer. He says the electronic eyes on the goal line may settle arguments, but still depend on probability. In a commentary in the journal Nature, he writes, the introduction of goal line technology will miss a huge opportunity to educate people about the role of uncertainty in science.
They're fantastic tools, but let's be realistic about their limitations, that science is about probabilities, and it's quite important that the public understands that. Now, what better way than to have this message in a game that's so popular?
Goal Control claims an accuracy of plus or minus 5 millimeters, well under FIFA's minimum requirement of plus or minus 3 centimeters. Fleming would like to see that number flashed on the screen. He says viewers could distinguish between replays and computer reconstruction and learn a little science.
And the wider point really is that science is central to many public debates today, whether that's climate change or nuclear power or genetic modification. Now, in all of these cases, science provides probabilities. It doesn't provide yes-no black-white answers.
But as goal line technology becomes an integral part of the sport, it's important to remember the referee, and not the computer, makes the final call. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
And speaking of football, according to a new study, repetitive heading the ball, a popular playing technique where players use their heads to hit and direct the ball, can cause brain injuries. Jessica Berman has the story.
Soccer is the world's most popular amateur sport. It's enjoyed and played seriously as a hobby by an estimated 250 million people of all ages around the world. But there's concern that repeatedly heading the ball, which travels at speeds of up to 80 kilometers per hour, can result in brain damage. Researchers at New York's Albert Einstein College of Medicine of Yeshiva University studied the brains of 37 amateur footballers selected from around the New York City area. All played soccer as a hobby for an average of 22 years, practicing two times a week and playing a competitive match at least once a week. Michael Lipton, director of the school's Magnetic Resonance Imaging Research Center, says investigators assessed how much heading each player had done for 12 months. The participants also took a series of tests that measured memory and brain function, and researchers used a high-tech MRI machine to scan the participants' brains. They wanted to see whether the amount of heading in each player was related to microscopic structural changes in the brain and performance on the memory tests. Investigators found that players who headed the ball 1,500 times per year or less had significantly less damage, such as lacerations to white matter, fatty tissue that covers the brain, which contains nerve fibers called axons.
But as you get to a higher level and cross a threshold, there is a sudden increase in the likelihood that we are going to find both changes in the brain tissue as well as worse function on our psychological tests, especially tests of memory related to that increased heading.
Lipton says mild brain changes and memory impairment similar to what's seen in concussions was seen in players who headed the ball 1,550 times or more per year, while players who headed the ball more than 1,800 times had the worst memory scores. Helmets used in American football have been shown to be effective at preventing skull fractures and bleeding in the brain, according to Lipton. But he says protective headgear is not likely to help with the type of brain injury caused by heading.
The type of injury that we're looking at here is due to rapid acceleration and deceleration or rotation of the brain inside the skull. It's sort of your brain sloshing around inside your skull as it moves.
Researchers will now try to determine the effect of heading in footballers of different ages and in different countries. The study on the effect of heading in amateur soccer players is published in the journal Radiology. I'm Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
Students at the University of Virginia have developed a new way of purifying water that they say could bring improved water quality for millions in the developing world. Carolyn Persuti has this report.
The lab operates like a kitchen. They add this ingredient and that.
Go ahead and pour that in here.
Mixing, weighing, pressing, and baking. What's created is called a Mate drop, a ceramic disc infused with silver. When dropped in water, silver ions are released to purify the water. And testing here at the University of Virginia shows clean, safe water. Bita Ade is a doctoral candidate at UVA.
It's not just about making a really great technology that effectively removes or kills bacteria and pathogens. It's about making a low cost, simple to use one tailored to people in developing countries who don't have many resources.
The students are experimenting with different sizes of Mate drops to correspond with different size water containers. Why the name Mate drop? The word Mati means water in Shivenda, a language of Limpopo province in South Africa. Here, 50 women run a water filter factory set up by the university last summer. The women mix sawdust and clay and make flower pot-shaped filters. The water flows through the filters to trap bacteria and solid particles to purify it. The factory sells the filters to local families. Manager Sutinya Kashion says the work has changed the women's lives.
When they get money for those pots, they're just buying a school uniform for their children.
But the Mati drop is smaller and less expensive than the filters. So over the next few months, students will conduct field trials of the Mati drop here in South Africa. Water experts say further testing will determine if the Mati drop is indeed a breakthrough. Maggie Montgomery is with the World Health Organization. She explained through Skype what field testing should reveal.
Do they find it convenient? Does it have a certain taste that they don't like to the water? What happens, you know, once it becomes exhausted?
If successful, the South African women will produce and sell Mati drops. The goal is to expand these factories to other developing countries and impact millions of lives per year. Jim Smith is the engineering professor leading the project.
Imagine a magic stone, and you take this magic stone and you drop it in your water container, and it purifies the water and makes it safe to drink. And then imagine that this magic stone only costs a few dollars. That's what the Mati drop is.
The project has been presented to the American Chemical Society and the American Society of Civil Engineers. Smith says he's received calls from corporations interested in producing the Mati drop, which just might mean Smith and his students have truly invented a magic stone. In Charlottesville, Virginia, Carolyn Pursuti, VOA News.
Okay, let's see if you have the right answer to this week's quick quiz. Today we wanted to know the name of the first Chinese female astronaut. From the following, was it A. Wang Yaping, B. Wang Zhengyi, or C. Liu Yang? The answer is C. Liu Yang. She became China's first female astronaut about a year ago when she went into space on June 16, 2012, as a crew member on the space mission Shenzhou 9. By the way, answer A, Wang Yaping, is the second Chinese female astronaut, and she's among the crew that was launched into space this past week. Answer B, Wang Zhengyi, was an 18th century Chinese astronomer-mathematician who had an interest in lunar eclipses. An impact crater on Venus was also named after her. Thanks for playing this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We'll have another brain teaser again for you next week.
You're listening to Science World, VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine.
While a number of scientists are looking to find life beyond Earth, one group of researchers has devised an explanation for how an essential component for creating Earth's earliest life forms came to our planet. The scientists found that a heavy bombardment of meteorites during Earth's earliest history delivered reactive phosphorus that, when released in water with other minerals, could be incorporated into prebiotic molecules so that life could form. The researchers found this form of phosphorus in ancient limestone that was abundant some 3.5 billion years ago. Matthew Pasek, an assistant professor of geology at the University of South Florida, led the team of researchers. He joins us today on our one-on-one segment to talk about the work that suggests life on Earth may have been able to get its start with a little help from deep space. Professor, you and your team found that a key element of life on Earth came to this planet eons ago. What was that element, and how did it get here?
The element is phosphorus, and phosphorus is an important element in biology. It's sort of the number five most important after carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen. And so phosphorus is important in making up your DNA and in controlling how you use energy, both in terms of getting energy and using energy. And it makes up our skeleton, so it's an important element in a variety of different functions.
Wasn't there any supply of phosphorus already here on Earth when the planet was formed and began its evolution?
Yes, there was. The Earth actually has a fair bit of phosphorus on the surface as well. A good portion of that may have come from meteorites, but a lot of it was already here. And so the thing with the phosphorus that's already present on the Earth is that when you have this phosphorus around, it's in the same mineral form as what our bones are made of. It's a mineral called apatite. And apatite is a pretty inert and non-reactive rock or mineral in many cases. And so in this way, it's one of those things that you don't tend to find it too reactive, which is great for our bones and our teeth, because if it was reactive, then it would dissolve away whenever you ate some food, and that would be pretty awful for our teeth.
If you could, bring us through a scenario with the phosphorus coming to Earth on a meteorite. How did life develop from that?
That's a great question. That goes on beyond the just the phosphorus idea. But if you have a meteorite, it dropped onto the surface of the Earth well after the Earth has kind of had a chance to kind of cool down and form oceans and things like that. And so the environment actually becomes better. And when you have an iron meteorite, iron and water tend not to go together very well and get rusting and things like that. And for at least phosphorus, the phosphorus will react with the water, generating these forms of phosphorus that are kind of unusual for the surface of the Earth. Most of the Earth's phosphorus is in a phosphate form, but when we have a meteorite, we actually get different forms. And it's actually the different forms that we see in the old rocks that give us this idea that meteorites were important. But if you have this meteorite sitting on the surface and sitting in some water, and some organics are also in that water, things like sugars or alcohols and things like that, they can sit and react with the meteorite and the phosphorus minerals and become phosphorus-rich biomolecules. And it does so pretty well, and we're getting some better idea of how well it is doing that and kind of figure out how these sorts of biomolecules even came about.
It's amazing how much the Earth changed since it came to be, the cycles that it went through. One thing I found interesting in the material about your study is you said that the conditions under which life arose on Earth billions of years ago are no longer present today. Now, what are we talking about? What were those conditions?
Well, one of the biggest condition change is how life has actually changed the atmosphere. So all the oxygen that you're breathing even today is made by photosynthesis by plants that turn sunlight and carbon dioxide into oxygen and sugars. And that oxygen comes around and wreaks havoc on a lot of different very simple minerals. And it starts to oxidize them and rust them out and prevent some others from forming. And so that's definitely one of the biggest indicators that something was different is we see the rise of oxygen about 2.5 billion years ago. And before that, there was not much in the way of oxygen. It's hard to find rocks that kind of go back that far, but at least as far as we can tell, the atmosphere of the Earth did not have oxygen and had a number of different other things going on with it, one of which is this different variety of phosphorus that was probably present on the early Earth chemistry.
In doing the research and going through your findings, did you come across an aha moment or something that really surprised you?
Well, this was one of those moments in science that it kind of worked out well, because we've had this idea that meteorites could have delivered phosphorus for a little while. We first started doing research back in middle of the last decade. But in recent times, we've finally been able to develop the techniques available to analyze these rocks. And so it came about that once we started actually getting these techniques and could actually analyze them, this was the first thing I took a look at, were some of these old rocks I had sitting around to try to figure out what was going on with the phosphorus. And it was one of those, I think it should be there, and hey, it is there, yay! And that was the one of those very exciting moments of science when your prediction actually matches what you find, as opposed to going, whoa, what the heck is that, which is a lot of science as well.
That was Matthew Pasek, an assistant professor of geology at the University of South Florida in Tampa, Florida. That's it for this edition of Science World. Thanks so much for listening. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. Along with program information, you'll find stories, links, and much more. So stop by and visit us on the internet. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I am Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join us either online or on your radio next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.